questions, I attended the court proceedings remotely as they unfolded in London's High Court. And this is what I saw. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The High Court appeal took place on October 27 and 28 of 2021, lasting just 2 days. The United States is appealing Judge Bretz's decision not to extradite Julian Assange on 5 grounds. These 5 grounds can be summed up in 2 topics. Number 1, Assange's health, and number 2, the diplomatic assurances. We'll deal first with Assange's health. As we've mentioned before, Judge Baretzer blocked Assange's extradition to the U.S., namely on health grounds. So what has the United States responded? Well, the U.S. lawyers argue that she erred in her judgment, that she didn't apply the test correctly, that Assange doesn't meet the criteria for his extradition to be oppressive. They accuse him of essentially being a malingerer, someone who's pretending to be sick. Professor Michael Kupperman is the lead medical expert for the defense. Kupperman's testimony is very important because the judge relied heavily on it to block the extradition. She said that she preferred his testimony because his notes were more detailed than the other doctors. Kupperman also spent the most time with Assange. So because Kupperman's testimony is so crucial for the defense, the United States lawyers have tried desperately to discredit both the report and Kupperman. In his first psychiatric report, Kupperman did not disclose the relationship between Julian Assange and Stella Morris, or that they had had 2 children in the Ecuadorian embassy. Although this point has nothing to do with medicine or psychiatry, the United States is exploiting it to accuse Kupperman of misleading the court. They say that his medical evidence should be given little or no weight. Now, Assange's lawyers replied that Kupperman did not conceal anything from the court. He only kept the relationship secret because he was concerned for the privacy and safety of Ms. Morris and her children. This happened right around the time when we were finding out about Assange being spied on in the Ecuadorian embassy, among other things. In her ruling, Judge Bretzer did say that she found this behavior from Kupperman misleading and inappropriate, but an understandable human response to Ms. Morris' predicament. The lead prosecutor for the United States, James Lewis, accuses Assange of being a malingerer trying to avoid extradition. In the High Court, Lewis said that, quote, if he's clever enough, he can get around extradition. It then becomes a trump card, which cannot be dealt with by the requesting state, no matter if the prevention matters are 100 times better than in England. The prosecution argued that Assange did not meet the criteria under the Turner test, meaning he must be unable to resist the impulse to commit suicide. Only that could block extradition. Now, Assange's lawyers respond that Professor Kupperman did find this to be the case. Kupperman said that Assange cannot resist the impulse to commit suicide. If he's extradited, he will take his own life. Assange's lawyers also pointed out that there are people who make plans to take their own lives. That's not impulsive, but it's still driven by their mental disorder. And so it's unreasonable, it doesn't make sense, to say that Assange is not suicidal just because he's not impulsively suicidal. Now, the entire appeal hearing at the High Court is, of course, too large to condense into one episode, but nevertheless, it consisted of various accusations from the prosecution that the defense's medical experts were lacking in expertise or integrity. For example, that Kupperman had misled the court, that Dr. Dealey was wrong in his autism diagnosis, and so forth. Now, the other main topic discussed in the High Court was that of diplomatic assurances. The United States has said that if Assange is extradited, it will not place him in special administrative measures, or SAMs, which are some of the worst prison conditions imaginable. The U.S. also says that Assange won't be sent to ADX Florence, one of the worst prisons in the country. Robert Hood, the former warden at ADX Florence, described it as worse than death. The U.S. also claims that Assange could serve a potential sentence in his home country of Australia. In the High Court, I actually saw Lewis say that Assange can't be that suicidal because he can look forward to going to jail in Australia, as if going to jail in one's home country is something that every journalist dreams of. Now, the prosecution claim that they weren't given a fair chance to offer these assurances before, and had they, the judge would have decided differently. Well, Assange's lawyers point out that this isn't true. They say the United States had many opportunities to offer assurances that Assange won't be placed under SAMs. Instead, the prosecution not only said that SAMs are possible, but that they're okay. They said that Assange can play crochet and write poetry and self-recreate, which essentially means going into an adjacent empty room to spend time by himself. Now, Maureen Baird used to be the warden of a notorious jail in New York, Metropolitan Correctional Center, MCC. She testified at Assange's hearing and described what prison conditions are like in pretrial SAMs. She said that inmates were in solitary confinement, technically for 24 hours a day. There was absolutely no communication by any means with other inmates, and the only form of human interaction they had was when the guards came to inspect their cells or give them food through the slot in the door. Last year, when I was in court at the Old Bailey, I heard anonymous testimony from former employees of UC Global. UC Global is the Spanish firm in charge of security at the Ecuadorian embassy where Assange had been given political asylum. Now, the employees described how the United States got them to spy on Assange by installing cameras and secret microphones, and there were even discussions about physically hurting or kidnapping the WikiLeaks founder. And last week, for the first time, we saw the Yahoo News story brought up in court. Published in September, it has 30 U.S. officials admitting that the CIA was discussing plans to potentially assassinate Assange or kidnap him in London. This corroborated what we already knew from UC Global. Assange's lawyers pointed out that even former CIA Director Mike Pompeo confirmed this to be true. So if the decision to place Assange under SAMs is up to the Attorney General with kind input from the CIA, of course they're going to put him in SAMs. This is the same agency that was discussing maybe killing Assange. It's the same agency whose files he published in 2017 in the Vault 7 leaks. There is no doubt that they will put him in SAMs. Now, Assange's lawyers explained that even if Assange isn't placed in SAMs, which is certain he will be, he can still be put in other oppressive conditions. Mark Summers, Assange's lawyer, said, "You can proceed entirely confident that in the event of surrender to the USA, Julian Assange will enter into administrative segregation, ADSEG, at Alexandria for years." He added that ADSEG is isolation. There is no assurance from the US not to place Assange under ADSEG. All the evidence, including Kronberg's, is that ADSEG is in prospect for Mr. Assange. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, added that even if ADX Colorado is off the table, Assange would be sent to a communications management unit, or CMU. It's a prison within a prison, an experiment in social isolation. Correspondence is limited to 1 6-page letter a week to one recipient. And in regards to being sent to Australia, Assange's lawyer argued that, first of all, Australia hasn't even accepted or said yes. And even if it did say yes, who says that future politicians would agree? We have no idea who will be in power in 10 years when this process is actually finished. This is a process that could take a very long time, and Assange would most certainly be in isolation for the entire duration. That isolation would lead him to take his own life, as doctors confirmed to the court. Now, the United States lawyers said that these assurances are solemn undertakings given out at the highest order. These are not dished out like Smarties. Lewis added that the United States has never broken a diplomatic assurance ever. Now, Assange's lawyers don't believe that to be true. They say these assurances can't be trusted because they are worded in a way that binds the prosecutors but not the Department of Justice. So even if Assange is extradited and placed in SAMS and he complains, the Department of Justice can just say, "We never promised you that." Assange's lawyers gave examples of other people who were given false assurances by the U.S. They were extradited, thinking they'd be placed in a medical unit or hospitalized, and then sent instead to ADX. The United States even has a disclaimer in the assurance where it practically admits that Assange will be placed under SAMS. It says very clearly, Mr. Assange will not be subject to SAMS or imprisonment at ADX unless he does something that would warrant them, like threatening national security. This means they certainly will place him under SAMS because the whole case is built on the false premise that Assange and WikiLeaks endangered national security. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, added that even in the event of acquittal in the United States, what Gordon Kronberg could do is summon him before a grand jury, incarcerate him for civil contempt, and place him in a special housing unit. So even if Assange is acquitted, he could still go back to jail. And it's not just a possibility, it's actually a likelihood, because Kronberg did precisely this to Chelsea Manning when she refused to testify against Julian Assange. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now joining me is Kevin Gostola, an American journalist whose work focuses on whistleblower and national security cases. Besides the Assange court hearings, he's also covered the cases of Chelsea Manning, John Kiriakou, Daniel Hale, and others. Kevin is also the managing director of Shadowproof, as well as producer and co-host of the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. So Kevin, given the United States history, what they've done to other prisoners who were also given so-called assurances, not diplomatic ones, but nevertheless, they were misled, weren't they? I mean, if we look at what they did to Daniel Hale just a few months ago, or Chelsea Manning, which you both covered, do you lend these diplomatic assurances any credence above others?
All four of these assurances have significant loopholes. I'll start with the more generic thing that we should really look at, which is the UK government is supposedly the government that would represent Julian Assange's interests if he did not think the U.S. government upheld the assurances that are given by the U.S. government. So in other words, what we see in the United States' argument to the High Court of Justice that we should trust the U.S. government's assurances is that he would have the ability to file some kind of a challenge if he didn't believe that they were being upheld. And he would first go to the UK government and they would tell the US government that Julian Assange says he isn't getting the medical care he needs, or he believes it's wrong that he's been put in special administrative measures, or that he's in these restrictive solitary conditions in Alexandria Detention Center while waiting to be put on trial. And that is ridiculous because the UK government, I can't imagine wanting to be any sort of ally of Julian Assange given what they've done. Well, first off, this isn't really even about the case, but we know from Italian journalist Stefania Marizzi that the UK government has actively fought Freedom of Information Act requests for basic details about what these services in the country, like the Crown Prosecution Service, I think she might have even asked for records from the police department, what they were doing in order to target people who are associates of WikiLeaks, like Kristen Harrafson, who's now the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Joseph Farrell, Sarah Harrison, who, by the way, is an unindicted co-conspirator in the latest indictment in this case, something that is concerning. And so she's asked for these records, and they won't give them to her. And then also... We know that there are records that have been destroyed historically related to the Assange extradition, going back to the Swedish case. But in the last decade, we know that there are records that no longer exist because the government actually destroyed those records. And this is the government we're supposed to believe will advocate for Assange to the U.S. government, that he should not be mistreated and that his human rights should be upheld. It's laughable.
You know, we heard things in court about how Assange could communicate with prisoners above and below through the plumbing. You know, Kronberg insists that ADSEG is not isolation. I mean, what do you think of not just ADSEG, but also the other kinds of hell holes they could put Assange in, right? Because his lawyers pointed out there's a possibility of being sent to a CMU or an SHU. I mean, are these, you know, prisons that different from ADX? You know, having covered Chelsea Manning and Daniel Hale's trials, you know all too well that they have a way of putting these people through enormous suffering, don't they?
Yeah. So let's take Chelsea Manning. She went through untold amounts of suffering for a year in a jail, refusing to cooperate with this grand jury. And toward the end, she attempted suicide yet again. Another time, she had attempted suicide when she was at Fort Leavenworth serving her sentence, her military prison sentence. So again, this put her in a position where she was near a psychotic break, and she attempted suicide, and she did that because of the conditions of her jailing, her detention. while she was resisting a grand jury subpoena. She didn't know when she was going to be released. She ended up being released a few days after attempting suicide. This happened to her. If it happened to her, it could happen to Julian Assange while he's awaiting trial. This is the same jail that Daniel Hale was sent to while awaiting sentencing. They put him in there because they wanted to make everyone believe that his post-traumatic stress that he has from the moral injury of being involved in the drone program was something that was driving him crazy and he was going to do self-harm to himself. His therapist actually ratted him out to pretrial services, and he ended up being thrown in jail and not able to prepare himself for going to prison. You know, do things like find a home for his cat, take care of any bills that he had, outstanding payments, put all of his things in order so that he could then go to prison. Something that a lot of people get to do when they know that they're going to be going off to prison. And they deprived him of his ability to do that. He was just picked up, taken to a jail, and he hasn't been free since. And now he's in a CMU, a communications management unit, and there he is in conditions that, in terms of social visits, it's actually worse than special administrative measures. It's been described as worse by the Center for Constitutional Rights because you do not have contact visits with any individuals who come to see you. So immediate family come, Stella, her children, his children come, Gabriel and Max, and he's on the other side of a partition. There's glass. He speaks, you know, I think he grabs the telephone, think of like the movies where they talk through the glass. He never gets to touch. He never gets to hug. He doesn't get to kiss his kids. They don't get sit on his lap. He doesn't get to share any moments with them while he is in this facility if he gets sentenced to a CMU.
So besides an SHU or a CMU, I mean, what else could they do? Because ADSEG is pretty much guaranteed. If you ask me, SAMs are also pretty much guaranteed. Do you also feel that way, that these things are you know, practically set in stone for Assange?
Well, the other thing we should be concerned about, and Kronberg lays it out very clearly, is that Assange could be put in protective custody because he's a high-profile prisoner. And what that means is they get to do all sorts of things that they did to Chelsea Manning when she was first detained and was awaiting trial. You remember the international scandal that was sparked by her treatment at the Quantico Marine Brig, which has since been shut down. It actually does not exist. There are not people detained there anymore. And so, and in that facility, I remember they took her clothing away, they took her underwear away, they took, they made her wear the suicide smock, which I saw displayed during the court martial. I saw her put it on and demonstrate what it was like. It's just like itchy, uncomfortable thing that like nobody would be comfortable sleeping in. And especially in a prison. And they did this to her by twisting her words against her and reading into it the worst intentions. It was sarcasm, or she was talking about, you know, like, if you're going to do this to me, I could take the elastic in my waistband and I could do this with it. And then just, I guess, to be a smart aleck, the military person who was overseeing her treatment decided, well, we need to take this seriously and take all of the clothing away. And when they called roll in the morning, she came out of her cell and she's completely naked, and everyone else has on what they're wearing in the prison. And everyone, you know, the people who are doing security for that prisoner, sort of like, why does this inmate not have any clothing on? She was treated like that as part of protective custody, the idea that they had to make sure no matter what, she survived and made it to her trial. Don't think they won't do the same thing to Julian Assange. They will say that they are putting him in restrictive conditions to protect his own safety in order to prevent him from doing anything to himself. They will take his mental health. They will use all of the worst claims that the defense has made to try and save him, and they will turn them against Julian Assange so that he is even more miserable, if you can believe it. And you may not think, how could you be more miserable? They will find a lower low that they can take this while he is in confinement.
So, Kevin, a lot of people ask you and me when we're covering this case, when we'll get a decision from the judges, where we think this is going. When you or I were talking last time, you pulled out this very big chart with all the possibilities of where Assange's judicial process could go. Could you maybe walk us through all these various outcomes?
Yes, so if you look down at the left part of the screen toward the middle, you'll see that it says the U.S. appeals to the High Court. That's where we are. We're also, I think there's another box that has U.S. appeals to the High Court, but that's not the same route. Anyways, if you go down to the bottom here, now where you're circling, there are three actions that can happen. The court can dismiss it. Well, then what's going to happen is the U.S. will appeal and it'll go before the Supreme Court. If it accepts these assurances, these diplomatic assurances that we do not find to be of any value, then it'll potentially go back down to the district court level. And so you basically go back to go, and you have a hearing before, I hope it would be a different judge and not Vanessa Beretzer, but I suppose things have been kind of bizarre already, so maybe she gets to have another crack at it. But again, I would think that it would be a different judge. It should be. And they would have a hearing on these assurances and discuss why the legal team for Assange would have a hearing much like the extradition hearing in September 2020. And they would say, look, you know, we're sorry we have to do this. We don't like being here. The U.S. should have put these forward a long time ago, but now they have. And we're here to put evidence and bring forward witnesses and say that we do not believe that these assurances should be taken seriously. And then the judge would review them and decide, based on those assurances, whether to reject the extradition request or not. And then the appeals continue, and we go back to the High Court for another hearing, and then we go back to the UK Supreme Court for another hearing. And then that's the last stage.
Kevin Gostola, thank you so much for your time and your brilliant reporting. Keep up the good work. It's a pleasure speaking with you. No date has been set by the judges on when they will hand down a decision, but they did say they were given a lot to think about. And I agree, there is a lot to think about. Namely, why is this entire hearing focusing on Assange's health? You know, we can now see very clearly why January's decision was a positive but an inadequate one. While the judge blocked the extradition, which is good, she only did it on health grounds. Meanwhile, the political charges, she agreed with them all. So right now, the whole discussion has shifted to Assange's health. You know, WikiLeaks published evidence of war crimes carried out by U.S. forces, intelligence agencies, and their allies. But instead of holding those politicians and soldiers accountable, the British justice system, at the behest of the United States, is putting Julian Assange on trial. And not just that, but his mental health on trial as well, reinforcing negative stigmas and stereotypes about mental illness. And when we talk about assurances, it's very important to point out the U.S.'s broken promises it made to other prisoners many times before. They purposely word these things in a way that binds the prosecutors, but not the Department of Justice, which means they're useless because the Department of Justice is the only one who has the power to grant these assurances in the first place. Let's be clear on something. Even if Assange were in perfect health, he should not be extradited because it is the wrong thing to do. Even if the United States says it will place him in a five-star hotel, it's still not okay to extradite him for doing his job. What is happening here is unprecedented. This is a vendetta. It's a witch hunt against Assange because his journalism threatens the most powerful armies and governments on Earth. A journalist should not have to prove that they are sick and suicidal beyond hope just to avoid extradition to a foreign country they have no connection to. If Julian Assange is suicidal in the first place, it is because they have made him this way by persecuting him. He has been persecuted by the same government that now claims it will treat him well. I'm sorry, but if you think the United States is not going to lock up Julian Assange in some dark hellhole the moment he sets foot on U.S. soil, then you're really kidding yourself. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has inflicted heavy damage on Iran over the past 3 years due to its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal. The United States must apologize, compensate the losses, and compensate for Iran's lack of benefit from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. We now present you an article written by Abdulreza Hadizadeh. The piece is titled, Why Does Iran Say We Do Not Have Nuclear Negotiations? The first step in any negotiations is that the participants must share common views on the issues that will be discussed. The main topic takes center stage and viewpoints on its resolution will be put to consultation by the countries participating in the negotiations. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian and his deputy Ali Bagheri-Kani are seeking to build a common understanding about the nature of future discussions with the 4+1 group through making trips and phone calls with their counterparts. In this regard, the Islamic Republic of Iran stresses that it will not participate in any talks revolving around the nuclear issue and that the country's nuclear program will not be the topic of any future negotiations. But what is the reason for such a position in the talks, which are set to start on 29th of November? The case of negotiations related to Iran's nuclear issue was closed in 2015, and the parties achieved significant results. In the course of the talks leading up to the nuclear deal between Iran and the 5+1 group, the Islamic Republic of Iran faced unsubstantiated and political allegations. The country had also been subjected to attacks and questions that led it to be unjustly accused by Western media. Therefore, Iran had to build the necessary trust to show its goodwill and seriousness. So Iran made large-scale retreats in the field of peaceful nuclear energy before the lifting of sanctions. This issue was strongly challenged inside the country. Critics of the agreement in Iran raised the question of why the Zionist regime is engaged in non-peaceful nuclear activities without being a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. While Iran is not supported by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and even punished in some way despite its membership of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, and extensive cooperation with the United Nations Atomic Watchdog, the IAEA. The negotiations reached a conclusion, and all countries were obliged to honor their commitments based on a specific timetable. According to the nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the International Atomic Energy Agency was responsible for verifying Iran's practical measures at its nuclear sites. Later, in 16 reports, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, confirmed Iran's goodwill and the Islamic Republic of Iran's full implementation of the nuclear agreement. These verification reports proved that Iran's nuclear issue was only a political case brought by the country's enemies and rivals. Iran's full commitment to the nuclear restrictions took place while the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama violated the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action through various sanctions and pressures. After that, the unilateral and illegal withdrawal of Barack Obama's successor, Donald Trump, from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action completed the unfinished work of the Democrats, and thus the United States practically violated an international agreement as well as the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. Other JCPOA members either failed to provide Iran with the economic benefits of the deal or, like the three European countries, sided with America. Hence, the United States and the European states are accused of reneging on their obligations. After the U.S. pullout from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, the Islamic Republic of Iran exercised more than 2 years of strategic patience to prevent the collapse of the nuclear pact. Then, Iran decided, in accordance with Articles 36 and 37 of the nuclear deal, to expand its peaceful nuclear activities and take reciprocal measures in the face of the blatant violation of the agreement. The difference between the political actions of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States of America was that Washington, through its withdrawal from the JCPOA, breached the international agreement and violated the UN Security Council Resolution 2231. While Tehran expanded its nuclear activities according to the mechanisms and methods in the agreement itself to reaffirm its commitment to the failed deal. However, according to opinion polls, the U.S. government's measures seriously damaged and weakened the nuclear deal and significantly increased the Iranian people's distrust towards Washington. Investigation into one JCPOA signatory's violation of its commitments is now the subject of the talks, and other axes of the negotiations will be formed around it, the most important of which are as follows. 1. The Islamic Republic of Iran will by no means renegotiate its previously negotiated nuclear issues. Other subjects such as missiles and regional issues will also be off the agenda of the talks. 2. If the US government allows itself to completely change its policy towards international obligations after the change of each government, it must give the new Iranian government the right to at least oppose part of the Vienna talks under the previous administration and call for the beginning of new negotiations. And 3, the U.S. government's unilateral and illegal move has made the high wall of mistrust between Iran and America stronger and more stable. If current U.S. officials regard as wrong the path pursued in the past administration and they regret it, they should take confidence-building measures right now. Unfortunately, so far, despite U.S. President Joe Biden's criticisms of his predecessor Donald Trump's policies towards the nuclear deal, and Iran has not seen any serious change in this regard. Hours after taking office, Joe Biden issued 17 executive orders to annul the previous administration's decisions. But regarding Iran, Biden continued Donald Trump's legacy and strategy. This matter intensified the need for U.S. to build trust. And 4, the U.S. has inflicted heavy damage on Iran over the past 3 years due to its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal. The United States must apologize, compensate for the losses, and compensate for Iran's lack of benefit from the JCPOA. 5, following confidence-building measures, the United States must completely fulfill its obligations under the JCPOA. It must remove visa bans as well as Iran's Sanctions Act. The Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act and more than 1,500 sanctions imposed on our country by the U.S. government since its signing of the JCPOA. 6. Iran should have ample time to verify the normalization of its trade and the transfer of currency into the country. 7. The United States must commit itself not to violate its obligations with the change of government in the country. Additionally, due to the growing distrust towards the United States, its ability to trigger the snapback mechanism should be blocked and locked. And 8. With the lifting of sanctions and the compensation for damage inflicted on Iran, along with America's commitment not to renege on its obligations again, Iran can take steps to return to the restrictions imposed under the JCPOA, and thus the nuclear deal can be revived. Moreover, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says Tehran and the remaining parties to the landmark nuclear deal of 2015 can reach a good agreement in a short period of time, only in case of a serious and positive approach to the upcoming talks slated to start in the Austrian capital Vienna at the end of this month. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said in a post on Instagram recently, "The Islamic Republic has no intention to be locked in the stalemate remaining from the previous negotiations. I believe that if the opposite side enters in the Vienna talks with a serious and positive approach, it will be possible to achieve a good agreement in a short amount of time." The top Iranian diplomat said it was necessary to once again outline Iran's stance and views about the sanctions removal talks in Vienna as the date of the negotiations has been finalized. He noted that he held detailed and separate phone calls with the foreign ministers of the 5+1 group countries, that is China, Russia, Britain, Germany and France, recently, and emphasized that the Islamic Republic of Iran would pursue a result-oriented approach to the talks and is determined to achieve a good agreement. Amir Abdollahian emphasized that achieving a good agreement calls for the effective and verifiable removal of sanctions and the return of the opposite side to their full obligations according to the nuclear deal. He said Washington's behavior, including in imposing new sanctions against Iran, has made the provision of its objective guarantees an unavoidable necessity. The Iranian foreign minister noted that his deputy and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, held explicit and useful talks in European capitals in recent days. Hossein Amir Abdollahian further said, "As I have repeatedly emphasized, the administration of the Islamic Republic of Iran will continue the policy on the expansion of balanced ties with countries based on mutual respect and common interests, with seriousness, and is determined not to tie the improvement of bilateral and multilateral economic cooperation to the issue of the JCPOA."
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo choo ka-choo. It's the Youth Station for you. I'm your train driver today, Muzaffar Haider. Here is the conductor.
You introduce yourself again.
Mehdi Najafi. Guys, yeah. This is Mehdi Najafi.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
And when I was really little, in fact, not even really little, I think I must have been around 15. So I was in a really bad school and stuff. So I saw a fire extinguisher. And we were a fire extinguisher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we used to pull the pins off them.
Yeah, and then?
But then one thing led to another, and then eventually I walked into a classroom, and, you know, it was an ICT classroom. Everybody's sitting at their computers, and they're all chatting away, and the teacher wasn't looking. So we walked past it, and I pushed the fire extinguisher, and I thought it would just be a little squirt, but it was one of those kind of explosive fire extinguishers. Yeah. It just goes, and everywhere was just full of this white puffy foam.
Yeah.
And then we quickly ran out again. So I think it was a little while before there that I realized that obeying the rules is just not fun. It's much more fun to break the rules.
Yeah. Well, just the fact that you know that you're breaking the rules gives you this blood rush.
Yeah.
When you're a kid, especially.
Ah, Wouldn't adulthood
if you get addicted to that blood rush, then you grow old with that blood rush.
Yeah. Is that a bad thing?
Yeah. What?
I'm still breaking loads of rules, so I'm cool with that.
Yeah, whose rules are you breaking?
The Tahoot's rules now, you know.
Yeah, you know. If you want to be a rebel on the right side.
Yeah, son. But the rebellious streak in and of itself is a good thing.
Yeah, if you channel it rightly.
How do you channel it rightly?
Against the right enemy. It's been a long time since humanity has realized that there is an enemy within them.
Yeah.
You know?
I wanted to discuss the idea of this premise, actually, which we've just confirmed. You know, this premise that breaking the rules is fun.
You know that?
Obeying the rules is boring.
It is. Why?
Huh?
Why? Because it is in the nature of the human being to be tempted towards certain things that he is being blocked away from, stopped from.
Yeah, the one tree that Adam was told, Prophet Adam.
Yeah.
The one tree, don't go to this tree. And what does he do? He goes to that very tree.
Yeah, and if he wasn't told, he might not.
Yeah, he wouldn't have noticed it.
Yeah, there's this joke I got reminded of. This guy goes to a fake doctor, and fake doctor, like a spiritual fake doctor,
yeah.
Right? And he goes to him, he's like, I've got this problem. He's like, I've got the cure for you. Pray a 2-unit prayer, right? He's a fake spiritual doctor.
Right.
He's like, pray a 2-unit prayer, but don't think about a rabbit. He's like, don't think about a rabbit,
right?
So if he hadn't told him, he would never thought of a rabbit, like. But now that the guy told him to not think about a rabbit, all he's thinking about in that prayer is the rabbit.
That's actually really brilliant what you just said. Wait, is there more to the story?
Sorry? No, that's the story. Like, when you're told not to do something, it just sticks to your head, you know?
Right?
And that fake doctor knew he was smart, right? You have to be smart to be fake sometimes. And
yeah.
I don't have the cure for his problem, but if I'm going to tell him to do something that he can't do, then he can't complain, you know. Like, don't think about a rabbit. And all he could think about was a rabbit
all the time. The shayateen are telling us, don't think about this, don't think about that. It's not always the voice of God, guys. The shayateen are very clever at what they do, and sometimes they're just putting these messages in. They might put don't before the sentence, right? But the sentence is still there. Somebody said that it's really profound that the human race is so strange that they have to be told not to kill. Have you thought about that? Like the Ten Commandments, for example.
Wow,
one of the commands is don't kill. Now, why should the human being need to be told something which is so inherently obvious? Why? Have you thought about that? That means that there's something within us. We are hardwired to do things which are evil in nature. To kill others. Think about it. You're spilling the blood of another human being. Well, we who are more or less from a civilized society, modern society, we can never even dream about it. But this is what we are. And so sometimes we actually need to be told not to do the most obvious things. It's like a child, you know. This fire is going to burn you. Don't put your hands in the fire. And then he goes and tries to do it. And then he realizes that this is actually going to hurt me. I should have listened to daddy or mummy.
It does depend on the society itself also, right? Because they were told that we do need to analyze what kind of history that they had and what kind of mental upbringing in the generations before them and that specific generation itself had, right? The type that they were, they had to be told, right? Not every human being has to be told. Do not kill, right? Some people have grown into enjoying certain things and others do not enjoy that thing, right? And why did you say that it was always fun breaking the rules? Because you had grown to like that feeling of breaking the rules, right?
I guess, but it can also be argued the rules were just genuinely boring. You want you to just sit and listen to the teacher. This is boring.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as we said, that depends whose rules you're breaking. Right?
Sometimes, if you get a really good teacher, obeying the rules is more fun than disobeying them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really rare, unfortunately. All right, I'm going to ask you to just hold that thought. We're going to come right back after a break. ¶¶
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Yeah, some teachers are so engulfing that you actually like their company. They make it so enjoyable, the lessons and the rewards or little tricks and treats and all these stars that they put on different charts and boards.
I guess if that's actually a big key that we've just uncovered, found. Look, that then depends on how you view Allah. Do you see him as that boring teacher?
Mm.
Or do you see him as that fun, exciting teacher? See, when you're in the class and you're listening to the boring teacher, it is boring and you want to now break the rules. But if you're like in a bright classroom with the teacher who's really expanding your mind and your vision, and you know the class is enthusiastic about, if you're seeing God as that kind of teacher, then you will get pleasure from obeying him. Now, if you look at the majority of people who have that rebellious streak and it's being misdirected, especially the youths, when they're not interested in the deen, it's because they see the deen as black and grey and dull. Those youths who get inspired by the deen, though, they are those who recognize that, wow, this deen is amazing.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, once at night, the middle of the night, he was going somewhere, and one of the companions saw him, he was like, where are you going? He was going in a rush, you know, like when there's a room full of candy and you let a little child off and he just runs towards the candy, he doesn't even look back who's behind him or who's calling out to him, you know. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was going, like, with that passion, he was running that. And the companion asked, where are you going right back? Like, what? Saw the enthusiasm in after midnight, and Imam says, "Da'ni," he's like, "Leave me." Where was he going? To pray Salatul Layl.
Okay.
He's like, "I'm going towards my Mahbub." That is the pleasure that he gets out of the conversation, Salatul Layl with Allah Subhanahu wa Taala, and that's the enthusiasm, right?
Yeah.
So it comes back to what you just said. He has found the fun. He's found the enjoyment in nearness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
What are the barriers to finding that fun? How do you... Because look, so much of this is the trick between enjoying destroying your akhirah and the fun in making your akhirah. You can get pleasure from both of them, right?
Mm.
How do you do it? This dunya is going to end eventually. How do you enjoy those things which are good for you? How? How do you enjoy the salah? Let's go to the highest example. If your salah is accepted according to the ahadith, all your amal is accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll use salah as an example, but it can be applied to your homework or your chores or whatever you need to do. How do you do it? How do you enjoy it? What are the barriers that stop you from enjoying it?
Ourselves. There's a book by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, about prayer. He explains the way you can pray. There are certain things, for example, when we pray, we have to be sure that there's nothing that is waiting after prayer. Like, so if I'm anticipating something after prayer, material, my mind's diverted towards that thing, you know. I have to be calm, I have to be relieved physically, I have to be... Like, certain things, those are the physical aspects to it. And, you know, I don't want to be someone who's an example of لِمَ تَقُولُونَ مَا لَا تَفْعَلُونَ, you know, why do you say something that you do not do yourself? But as we've been taught, and as... we might have experienced to a very minor level, abstaining from certain things, you know, does give you a certain pleasure. Tangible example is not eating for a long time. Have the same ice cream with a full stomach and try having that the same ice cream after 8 hours of no food. Mm-hmm. Which one are you going to enjoy?
The one where you've had no food.
No food, right? Yeah. And what I'm trying to point to is that certain abstinence does have a hidden pleasure to it.
Man, hence comes in the religion of Islam. And those parents who actually limit us as well, because we don't realize how much they've actually extended and increased our pleasure of life. That's what Islam really did. That's what good parents really did. Okay, now let me give you the example of PlayStation, right? I was only allowed to play PlayStation on the weekend for an hour, maximum 2 hours.
Wow.
Because all my friends got to play it whenever they wanted, every single day. If they weren't in school, they were playing PlayStation.
Mm.
And one of my friends, his name was Stevie, and I was really, really jealous of him, man. He could play PlayStation any time, literally, he wanted to. And he was bored of it. When I look back, I realized he was absolutely bored of, to the point where he would actually take his PlayStation games. I remember he took Crash Bandicoot 3, which was a brilliant game back then, And he snapped it.
That bored.
He was that bored. I said, what are you going to do with it? I really want to play that game. I only get to play on the weekend and stuff. He said, no, I'm probably going to just break it. I was like, kids are really mean, man. He took my... He firstly lent it to me, so I played the entire game, yeah. Right? Took me weeks and weeks because I only get to play on the weekend.
Yeah.
But I was really... I was like, oh, that's such a good game. I love it. I enjoy it so much. He took it back just so he could break it. But anyway, my point was, because he wasn't limited, he did not enjoy it. His pleasure became less and less and less.
Which is why we see that in our society we're going towards drugs and, like, yeah. superior drugs and superior drugs. A sober life isn't enjoyable anymore because you have no restrictions.
You have no restrictions.
Right? Can we head for a break so I can
get... Oh, you need a break?
Yeah, I need a break.
All right, yeah, no, that's fine. We'll come back after a break then. In other words, if you want to extend your pleasure, restrict yourself. That's what Islam is actually... It's all just a fantasy. It's a trick. Dear youths out there, if you ever think that Islam is there to burden you and to take away your pleasure, it's not. It is actually there to increase your enjoyment of life. Only those who fast will know the enjoyment of that first date.
The edible date,
yeah.
Only those who do understand the pure relationship of a legitimate Islamic marriage are going to understand the real pleasure of a date.
Now, obeying such rule, it's actually extending the pleasure and the fun of life. So lots of people do think that, assume that, oh, well, it's restricting me, I'm not going to be able to have fun and not even enjoy it.
Extending fun is the right word for it, right? There's so many people. Go out in the West. What do you see? What do you see in terms of people's psychological state, mental state, after, say, a Saturday night? Sunday.
Really bad.
Sunday,
depression,
right?
Depression.
Friday
sadness,
and Saturday is okay. They're in the bubble. But what happens after that bubble has popped? Sunday. It's gone. It's... Your life is limited to 1 week. You're looking forward to that Friday and that Saturday night, and even at that Saturday night, within that, there's nothing left for you now, right? And you feel that emptiness once that's gone, right? What's that pleasure? How long does that pleasure last? Oh, if you call it pleasure, right?
Not very long.
A few hours,
and that's
right?
Why people are just completely depressed. They do get depressed because of this kind of lifestyle. That's all we have time for, unfortunately. Inshallah, in the future, we'll discuss it more if Allah gives us the tawfiq. From myself and from Brother Mahdi Najafi, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is
pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.